One of the four Republicans running for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin, banker and hedge fund manager Eric Hovde, is defending his voting record this week. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported last week that Hovde voted in just two of the 11 elections he could have voted in when he was living in Washington, D.C. He voted in the 2004 and 2008 general elections for president, but that's it. He said he was too busy. He said as a conservative living in Washington, D.C., he didn't have conservatives to vote for. But when pressed on a Milwaukee talk show yesterday, Hovde said he should have voted.
It's a mistake on my part. I should have just said, you know, I'm going to go hold my nose, or not hold my nose, but go vote and make a protest vote. But, it, you know, and it's not an excuse.
How important is voting? Do you always vote in every election? Is it ever okay to skip going to the polls? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, July 26th. We'll discuss this issue that's going on in the Senate campaign, but we'll broaden our discussion to talk about voting in general. Should everyone vote? Is this a basic tenet of citizenship? What do you do if you don't like or you don't know about the candidates on the ballot? What do you consider your essential civic duties? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is this a big deal that Senate candidate Eric Hovde only voted in two of the 11 elections that he could have voted in?
Well, to a certain extent, it depends on which Democratic theorist you might speak to.
Mm-hmm.
Some would argue that you absolutely have to vote in every election whenever you have the opportunity. And others argue that not voting is not necessarily bad for the system. And in fact, it could be beneficial in some ways to the health of democracy and the ability of representatives to properly address the issues that are before the public. So I give you an equivocal answer at 6 o'clock in the morning. It depends.
Well, that's okay. Well, and we'll find out what our listeners think too. But do we think that this is an issue that voters care about?
I think voters will, because if somebody puts themselves out there as an individual who wants to represent the public, one has an expectation that they have put in the hard work of understanding the system. They think it's legitimate. They want to participate in the legitimacy of the system, and they want to try to affect public policy in a way that they think is positive. The most direct way that you do that is showing up at the polls whenever there's an election and casting your ballot. And so if you're investing yourself in running a campaign, one might wonder, why didn't you also invest the time and the effort into showing up at the polls in every election and voting?
And even if, as Eric Hovde said, he didn't really have a choice. He said in Washington, D.C., you had a choice of voting for a liberal Democrat and a liberal Democrat. And he said that as a conservative, he really didn't have a good choice. When going to the polls, you could write someone in. What?
Well, and that happens to a lot of voters around the country. If you look at enough electoral maps, you see them either very red or very blue, and although that sometimes is misleading because many states are actually more of a purple or a lilac color, a lot of voters don't really have a choice. If you happen to be a more liberal or Democratic voter in a red state, you often don't have choice, and the same thing for conservative voters in blue states. It's often about whether or not you want to make the choice to, as he claimed, make a protest vote or participate in a way so that at least you can indicate with your vote which way you'd like to see public policy go. And so it's certainly an explanation for why he did it and why there's a frustration from some voters when you basically only have a single choice. But it might not be a satisfactory excuse for the voters when it comes time to cast a ballot in the primary election.
Isn't not voting a statement in and of itself?
It is. And for a lot of Democratic theorists, what they would argue is that it's a demonstration that you're acquiescing to the current system, that everything is sort of even keel and you're satisfied with the way things are going. And you're not going to indicate a preference because you don't necessarily have a preference. You're satisfied or so absolutely dissatisfied that you're not going to go to the polls. Certainly, though, you need a number of people go to the polls so that the election looks as though it's legitimate. and that the people who wanted to cast ballots could actually cast a ballot. And, of course, that's part of the arguments behind voter ID laws, is whether or not you close the doors to some people will delegitimize the process. And so not voting can actually be somewhat helpful for democracy. And the reason that a lot of people see that is because that acquiescence to the status quo says to representatives, my interests are satisfied, you don't have to deal with me. The more people who show up to the polls, the more people who are demanding from government something, and it's incumbent upon the members of whatever institution, whether it's a legislature or it's the executive office, have to respond. And so often it's very difficult to respond to that cacophony of voices that are all screaming for something, their mm-hmm. own self-interest in government. Mm-hmm. So that can really complicate democracy when you have that many people screaming for something.
Yeah, yeah. Do we have any idea whether society would be much different if everyone voted?
Well, you know, there are nations that require you to vote. And so you see nations like Australia where the turnout is rather high. 85% of the adult population comes out. 98% of the registered voters will show up at the polls because they are compelled to do so by law. There are those who would argue that it's a problem because voters who have absolutely no interest in politics show up without the requisite knowledge to cast a meaningful vote. And so we get this percentage, and it's really unknown exactly what percentage of the public this is, shows up and sort of throws a monkey wrench into the process because they're in essence throwing darts at a bunch of names and not thoughtfully contemplating exactly what their vote should be doing.
We're talking with Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College, about voting. Is voting a basic tenet of citizenship? Do you consider this a requirement for a candidate who's running for office? Do you vote all the time in every election? When have you ever skipped an election? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be partly to mostly cloudy. Showers and thunderstorms are likely in the northwest today with a chance elsewhere. High temperatures in the mid-70s to around 80 in the north, in the mid-80s to near 90 in the south. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this afternoon during At Issue with Ben Marins after 4 o'clock, State Senator Tim Cullen will join Ben to talk about his decision to leave the Democratic caucus in the State Senate and become an independent. We will find out why he made that decision and the implications of that decision coming up after 4 o'clock this afternoon during At Issue with Ben Marins. We did invite Senator Cullen to join us this morning, but he was unable to do so. So we asked him if he could join Ben instead this afternoon, and he was able to do that. Right now we are talking about voting with Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. And before we continue on with our discussion about voting, Charlie, what do you make of State Senator Tim Cullen leaving the Democratic caucus and becoming an independent, apparently because the Senate Majority Leader Mark Miller did not give him the committee leadership position that he wanted?
Well, I think what you're seeing is someone who, after being out of politics for a while, returning and thinking that he was bringing to the institution a certain measure of knowledge and experience, and he wanted to use that experience in the short time that it looks like the Democrats might have the majority. And I think that being overlooked in that way was just not something that made him happy. It's something that leaders have to worry about. If you think back to 2006 when Joe Lieberman from the state of Connecticut was an independent because he lost the Democratic primary, he had to be treated with kid gloves because they needed his vote, and in many respects, they needed his experience. And although his weren't very public threats, there were intimations that he was also threatening to leave the caucus or not join Democrats in voting. So, you know, Mark Miller has to be very careful about the way he treats them. Of course, on the other hand, Senator Cullen has to worry about what kind of repercussions it might have for his own career, his own tenure in the institution, and for his constituents who might not benefit from particular legislation if he's angered leadership and they don't pursue things that he'd like to see pursued on behalf of his constituents. I think it might just be some hurt feelings. I suspect that Senator Cullen isn't going to leave the fold in a meaningful way, and by that I mean I don't think he's going to change his vote very much. He is a moderate. He has a reputation for working across the aisle. It will surprise no one if he tries to reach some sort of consensus with Republicans and Democrats. But, you know, they lose that kind of experience that he can bring to the table if they've upset him in this kind of way.
Does this mean anything in the, you know, the bigger scheme of things in terms of whether or not policies are voted in or voted out in the state Senate?
I think it depends on the policy. Again, I think that if you see the Senate under the Democrats trying to push very liberal policies, much like they abhorred what they perceived as very conservative policies from the Republicans, I think what you'll see is someone like Senator Cullen trying to work with the other side to find some sort of middle ground. That's the way it might affect it. But again, I don't see Senator Cullen changing his political stripes after a long career in Democratic politics.
And we will hear more from Senator Cullen this afternoon after 4 o'clock during At Issue with Ben Marins, and you'll have an opportunity to talk with him then. Well, we are talking about voting this hour because of this issue coming up in the race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. One of the Republican candidates, Eric Hovde, is defending his voting record this week. It was reported that Hovde didn't vote very much when he lived in Washington, D.C. He skipped 9 elections. He voted in the 2004 and 2008 general elections for president, but that was it. So we're talking about whether or not this is an important issue in the U.S. Senate race. And more generally, how important is voting in your mind, and whether you always vote, and whether you think it's ever okay to skip going to the polls. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Victor in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guests. I vote in every election. I'm 51 right now. I've been voting ever since I've been 18. President Carter was my first president. He got walloped by Reagan, but it didn't discourage me. But mine is a sense of duty. I'm Black American. I think of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. People suffered, died, lost everything for my privilege to vote. So mine is a sense of duty. And even though I vote for someone and they lose, I still feel you exercise your right to vote, because that cuts a pathway into saying, hey, I have a voice. I can go to a public meeting. The person may be Republican. I usually vote Democrat. I still have a say-so. And another thing people should keep in mind is these politicians do look at the voter list. You know, if you complain, regardless of what politics, more than likely, they're going to give an ear to you versus if they don't see any X by your name whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's an issue in this Senate race, Victor?
As tight as it is, very important.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, what do you think?
I mean, I think Victor is expressing what a lot of people express, is that to be part of the community, it is your duty. It's not just a right that you can choose or not choose to exercise, but it's something that you have to do for and on behalf of the community. It's about building an idea of community spirit and civic virtue. You won't be able to understand policy. You won't be able to understand those in your community unless you do the work to understand which way you should vote. So it's about investing yourself both in, you know, contemporary politics, and as Victor expresses, even generational politics, those who came before us and who laid a path for us to achieve what we can today. And so there are those who argue this is why you must go to the polls, because you are part of the community and you must exercise this right.
Thank you so much, Victor. You know, what do people say? I mean, we don't have a very good voter turnout usually. Usually, especially for non-presidential elections, it's very low. What's the excuse? What's the reason people don't go to the polls?
Actually, Eric Hovde expressed what is usually the most typical one that people will offer, which is that they're too busy. And, you know, part of the problem in the United States compared to a lot of nations is that we have this rather odd day on which we cast our ballots. It's a Tuesday in early November for most elections. In many nations, Election Day is a weekend day, or it's a holiday. They give everybody the day off so that you actually have the time to vote. A lot of other people say that they don't really have a choice, which is another expression that Hovde offered, that he didn't feel like he had a choice, that it was sort of the lesser of two evils kind of argument, and you don't really have the ability to make a thoughtful distinction between the candidates. Others will just claim just ignorance, that I don't know who they are, and for that reason I didn't feel as though I should or could cast a ballot. And that actually happens in elections, even, say, in a presidential election. People will be very comfortable casting a ballot for Mitt Romney or for Barack Obama, but then we see what's called roll-off, where people just don't vote for members of the underticket because they have no idea who they are, and they feel squeamish about casting that ballot. You know, when we look at this as political scientists, we actually borrow a lot from economics, and we think about it in terms of cost-benefit analysis. And even though people likely don't consciously do this, is what they're saying is what's the benefit to me if I go and vote? My one single vote that I'm casting, it's not going to make a difference between the costs that are associated with it. And sometimes they're economic, sometimes they're psychic, sometimes they're social, but people will sometimes make that little calculation in their head, and that's one reason why they don't vote.
Let's take another call from John in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for this program. I agree with Victor in Milwaukee. He's intelligent, he's well-informed, and I appreciate him voting regularly. I also vote regularly, but I've never understood this liberal dogma that we want and beg and plead with everyone to please vote. Most people are not informed enough to vote intelligently. Recent polls show that well over 50% of the people in America can't name their two senators. Why would I want those people to come and make decisions for me? They don't know anything. If anything, they may be influenced by the last billboard they see or the last commercial they hear. They're not thoughtful people. They don't study civics. They don't understand government. And frankly, I'm happy that those people don't vote. With respect to Eric Hovde, he's obviously an intelligent and well-informed man. I totally accept the reasons for not voting in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
He had two candidates that probably both support higher taxes and all kinds of liberal programs, and why waste your time voting among them? I wish he had voted, because I think he could have contributed something, but I would not hold it against him. I think he's a fine man and a fine candidate.
Yeah, John, thank you so much for your comments. I do want to know why you think it's a liberal dogma that people should vote.
Well, Joy, I listen and I watch and I read a lot. And all the people who cry about voter turnout, they're all liberals. They beg people to vote. They say, please, please get out and vote. I don't want those people to vote. If you don't think enough of our system, if you don't care enough, if you're not informed enough to know who your senators are, I don't want you to vote. But the labor unions, the teachers union, all the liberal groups want people to come out. And they want them to come out because their votes will be predictably liberal.
Is that accurate, Charlie?
Well, I think what you see in the data, and John is right in the sense that what you tend to see in the data of people who participate and vote routinely is that they are of a higher socioeconomic status, or SES as we often refer to it. And socioeconomic status generally deals with your rates of education, the typical work that you do, and the income that you produce for you and your family. And so what we see in the data is that people with higher SES vote at much higher rates than people with low SES. And this happens election to election to election. To John's point about whether or not you're educated enough, well, the data bear this out. The people with less education tend not to vote as much. Part of the problem is because you don't have much education, you don't understand the process, the duty, the effort it takes to do the research in order to understand the issues and the candidates to vote. But the question that has to be asked is, what do you have to have in terms of knowledge and understanding of the system and the process to be able to cast your vote? Is it enough just to cast your vote purely in your own personal self-interest? So if you know X party, and party is the largest cue that people use to cast a vote, if X party is going to give me Y, and that's my interest, is that enough for people to cast a vote and have the requisite knowledge to go to the polls? A lot of people would argue, yes, that's fine. As long as you're voting your raw self-interest, that's all you need to know. And if the cue you need is Democratic Party or the cue you need is Republican Party, then go to the polls and vote. You don't have to know the entire history of all the candidates and the way they will vote on every policy in order to be able to go and elect someone.
Teresa on Facebook says, I haven't missed any statewide national elections, but I have missed a few local elections because it is harder to find information on the candidates. And I happen to know, since Teresa is a regular contributor to this program, that she's an educated and an intelligent voter. That's sometimes a problem, isn't it? Especially with local races?
Even for political scientists, I find myself doing the same thing. We're fortunate. The Green Bay Press Gazette up here always puts out a nice insert in the newspaper so that you can run through everyone who's running for office, and actually even what offices are up, because sometimes it's hard to keep up with that, especially in Wisconsin where we have the nonpartisan races that come in April. A lot of states don't even have that. So, you know, it's difficult to do this work, and that's part of the cost-benefit analysis. If people feel as though, like John was expressing, I don't feel like I can go to the polls. I don't know who's even on the ballot. I don't even know what offices are up for election. They will choose not to go because that's too great of a cost to go and find out the marginal bit of information they need to cast that intelligent ballot for the people who are on up for election that year.
So, do you vote in every election no matter what? Why? What if you don't like any of the candidates running? Do you ever not vote? What's your opinion of people who don't vote? We are talking about the importance of voting and the role voting plays in our society. And we'll talk also about some other civic duties that are important in a democracy after we check the news. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Republican U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde is getting criticized by his challengers in the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin for not voting very much when he lived in Washington, D.C. He skipped 9 opportunities to vote. He said he was too busy. He said he didn't have a conservative choice to vote for on the ballot in Washington, D.C. He voted in the 2004 and 2008 general elections for president, but he skipped 9 other elections. And here are how some of his challengers are reacting, as quoted in Dan Bice's column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson said, I have voted every year in Wisconsin. And he added that the first time that Hovde is going to vote for U.S. Senate is for himself in Wisconsin. A spokesperson for Mark Newman, who's also running as a Republican for U.S. Senate, says about Hovde, it's bad enough he hasn't lived in Wisconsin for 24 years. He should have at least voted where he did live. And a spokesperson for Democrat Tammy Baldwin's campaign said that for someone who talks about running to be a citizen legislator, he sure doesn't walk the walk as a basic tenet of citizenship. So is voting a basic tenet of citizenship? Do you consider this a requirement for a candidate running for office? What are your thoughts on the role of voting in our society? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. And our next caller is Randy in Laval. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Say, thanks for having this conversation to the professor. I was the elected clerk in a township for 8 years, and during that time I saw this from a different angle. There's a lot of people put in a lot of work on every election, and when you show up to the polls, you do a couple things. You tell that local board that it's important to run a fair and open election and to train election workers. And when you go, there's always several issues, I guess not completely always, but generally, there's several issues on the ballot. And if you don't want to vote for a couple of liberal candidates, if you're conservative or vice versa, leaving those blank makes a statement. Often there's other issues you can choose. I guess I do find it, I do think that's, you know, probably an exposure Mr. Avdi has. It was probably, you know, nice of him to admit that it was. And it's just one more thing he's going to have to face. And I think candidates that do admit things like that are honest, and it's a mark that he was honest. But when your local board, that jurisdiction, bothers to train people, volunteers come, they watch, and many times now even volunteers come to watch the polls. People are taking it seriously. I would take issue with the individual who said people aren't qualified, maybe because they're not informed enough or not intelligent enough. I got to tell you, some pretty non-formally educated people I listen to now, the older I get, they've come by some wisdom. And if you think non-formally educated people, or that formally educated people are the ones who vote, I would invite you to come out here to the rural areas. I don't think those patterns hold, and we have a pretty good voter turnout out here. I think that...
I'm sorry, Randy, I didn't quite understand what you meant, that the rural voters who are coming out to vote are...
Well, in other words, the pattern... I took the professor to say that the patterns that hold are voters are always that vote are always more
Affluent and educated. I get it. So he's
so
yeah, okay. All right, Charlie, thoughts on that?
Well, just to clarify, they're not always affluent, but the tendency is that the greater your socioeconomic status, the more likely it is you're voting. It's not as though people with lower levels of education or income don't vote. It's just they vote at much lower rates than those of higher socioeconomic status. And I think Randy actually raises a really interesting point, and this goes to a discussion we had a little earlier in the hour about cost-benefit analysis of voter behavior. The United States is one of the only countries that puts all of the onus on the voter to figure out how to get registered to vote and how to vote. In most nations, the government is responsible for doing a canvas to see who is eligible to voting and creating the appropriate voter list, so that, in essence, it is costless for the voter. If there is an election and it's election day, they show up to the polls and cast their vote. You know, he's talking about this apparatus, which is wonderful. You can't thank the volunteers enough and all of those people employed by government who make the elections go virtually seamlessly and in a legitimate fashion. But it might help especially voters with lower knowledge and lower expertise understand the voting process if the government took some of this responsibility on. One of the issues in the United States today is that we have a population that is moving much more than it ever did before. If you were born and raised in an area, just the culture of place would lead you to know how to go vote there. But if you move, say, from Wisconsin to Missouri, well, the laws are different and things change, and now it's incumbent upon you to find out how you go and vote. And for a lot of people, that's too much of a cost, and then they disappear from the voter rolls because they don't want to invest the time and effort into it.
Yeah. And I guess, too, there's different ways to be educated about an election. Maybe somebody doesn't read every League of Women Voters brochure and search the internet and break down every commercial they see to fact check it. But they talk to friends and family and maybe get a sense as to which candidate is going to be best to vote for.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of sort of the process of community and civic virtue that a lot of theorists talk about. There's an author by the name of Robert Putnam, and he wrote a book called Bowling Alone several years ago. It was somewhat controversial, but he made this argument about social capital, that democracy can be healthier when we interact with people in the community and we understand and empathize with them. And the title is from some data he discovered that bowling leagues are disappearing, that people don't get together on Wednesday night and bowl anymore. And he argues that these kinds of civic associations are really important, because it could be the doctor and her husband, as well as the local mechanic, all on the same team or all in the same league, and you get to know them and understand them and learn from them. And then instead of just casting a vote that's purely your own self-interest, you're casting it because you've learned by working in these other orbits of the community and understanding what public policy can do for you. So voting alone, while it's a civic duty and possibly arguably an important one, you have to extend your political and social sphere beyond just that exercise so that you understand the community and public policy around you.
Well, you touched on it, but what are some of the other activities we should be participating in to our basic civic duties?
Well, someone like Putnam would argue that it's those traditional associations that that have really bound communities together, like the PTO and the PTA, the Rotary, these civic organizations that try to take the effort of the community and put it back towards the community. And again, you create this sort of web of connection among people so that you better understand what the needs are, so that we don't sort of bifurcate us as us and them, red and blue, and entrench ourselves with a particular somewhat myopic point of view. But he also argues that even something simple like a bridge club or a bowling league is a way in which you can introduce yourself into aspects and areas of the community that are unfamiliar to you, so that you become a better citizen in that way because you have a broader thought process. I talk to my students about this a lot in terms of the Real Housewives of Orange County, who live in a gated community and often don't go beyond those gates in any meaningful way. You need to be able to touch on those other elements, so says Putnam, so that you have a healthy working democracy.
Interesting. I was going to say, how did you do that? But now I get it. Bill in Oconomowoc is with us next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. You know, yes, this is kind of like a dream world kind of a thought, but I think it would be lovely if people had to fill out a questionnaire before they voted. And a couple of the questions would be, do you listen to Fox News? Do you listen to Rush Limbaugh? If you answer yes to that, then you need to step over to the brainwashing booth and have your brain cleansed before you can step into the voting booth and vote. Total. I'm not connected with you guys in any way, shape, or form, but you should listen to NPR. I mean, I don't know of too many other places where I can get a balanced view from Democrats and Republicans on any particular issue, much like I can with you guys.
Yeah, well, interesting, Bill. What about, Charlie, we're not going to be giving people tests before they vote.
Those, in essence, are unconstitutional because, in essence, it's a replication of literacy tests that were used in the South through the 1960s to try to exclude particularly African Americans, but it wound up excluding uneducated whites as well. So, no, we won't be giving them tests. But, you know, you understand the sentiment. It actually goes to this idea that Putnam offers, is that you don't want to place yourself in an echo chamber. Whether you're a liberal or a Democrat or a Republican or a conservative, it doesn't matter. The idea that Putnam is offering is that you have to lend your ear to the community so that you can make better choices. And it still might be the same choice you would have made, but it's better informed because you understand the impact your choice will have on the greater community. So I don't know if it's a deprogramming system we have to have more than it is trying to encourage people to join and to be part of their community in a more meaningful way.
Charlie Jacobs is an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College. We are talking about voting and whether voting is a mandatory civic duty and how important voting is in our society. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, wondering if you vote in every election, no matter what. Checking the weather forecast for today, partly to mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely in the northwest. There is a chance elsewhere. Highs today from the mid-70s to around 80 in the north, from the mid-80s to near 90 in the south. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 7, we will talk about famous people coming out or keeping their sexual orientation private. Sally Ride, who died this week, decided to reveal that she was gay in her obituary. But she did not make it widely public, even though she had been with her female partner for nearly 30 years. Coming up after 7, we will talk with the only Latina state representative in the Wisconsin legislature, Jocasta Zamarripa from Milwaukee. She announced this week that she is bisexual. We'll talk about why she decided to announce that this week, coming up after 7 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about voting with Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College. I'm really springing this one on you, Charlie, but any comment on the issue of whether sexual identity is an important thing for candidates to reveal in an election?
It seems to be more important today, and I'm not sure whether or not it's because the voters need to make the choice or whether or not the candidates themselves feel like they have to inoculate themselves against potential criticism by an opponent. And so I think it's one of those hot button issues today. And so if it affects you as a candidate, you think it's going to need to affect the decision made by the voters. I haven't seen much research or data on exactly what the interaction between the two is. So beyond that sort of casual opinion,
certainly didn't warn you that that's what we're talking about in our next hour, and we will we'll talk with her after 7 o'clock. Now we will continue our conversation about voting, and Pam in Madison is next. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Good morning. I have 3 quick points. When did voting become about an interest in politics as opposed to an investment in governance? And the second thing is, would it be effective or possible to write in no acceptable candidates instead of not voting at all? And my third point is deeply personal, which is hearing somebody say it's good that less educated voters don't vote is the highest form of elitism and completely un-American.
Thank you, Pam. Charlie?
Well, you know, voting has changed so much in the United States. Even if you just go back to the founding and the discussion about what voters are supposed to bring with them when they cast a ballot, to a certain extent, most early American thinkers about the process of democracy understood, or at least would have argued, that voters would have just cast their vote purely in a self-interested manner, because that's human nature. They were so imbued with the ideas of Enlightenment thinkers that nobody could get past the idea that somebody's just going to say, I need X, and so I'm going to go to the polls and vote for somebody who's going to get it for me. The argument was, is you need representative democracy to sort of distill that kind of self-interest through somebody who's more enlightened. And so it's almost a break on the self-interest of the people in the public. What we've seen over time, and actually this is some progressive reforms of the late 19th and early 20th century, is that we've wanted more direct participation, where the public is actually more direct in the way in which they express themselves. So things like recalls or initiatives and referenda, so that you can say, I want this particular policy and I don't want to use the conduit of my representative to get that done. So we've seen that sort of transformation over the last 100 years. Some argue it's wonderful because people have a real meaningful voice. Others say that it complicates the process because, again, we're all just going and voting our own self-interest. And I'm sorry, I forget her second question.
Well, her second question is very related to what Mike in Madison is going to say. So let me welcome Mike in Madison.
Yeah, good morning. Your thoughts regarding adding none of the above to the choices on the ballot?
Well, I think that it's sort of a more expressive way of doing what a lot of people do, which is not make the choice. They can't do it, what Eric Hovde, in essence, said he couldn't do. To go back to Australia, which I talked about earlier, the former prime minister said that he thought people should show up and vote, but if they don't feel like they understand or know or want to even cast the ballot, that they should just turn it in blank. I think it's certainly an alternative. I'm not sure whether or not the parties would appreciate it, because they might feel as though it might actually draw people to that category and away from just picking a party. Again, knowing the cues that that party labels bring, the parties themselves and politicians might object because it might hurt their chances at election or re-election. For the time being, we have it. It's just that it's not explicit on the ballot.
Yes, that Pam said she wanted to be able to write in no acceptable candidate. And I suppose you could write that in if you wanted to.
You can technically do it right now. It's just it's not going to show up anywhere because it won't register on any of the machines.
Next, we go to Mike in Mindoro. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. We always talk about the casting of ballots at the polling places, but we never discuss the other important aspect of Wisconsin voting life is our town meetings and our annual school meetings. Those 10, 15 people out of 40, 50,000 people from large school districts make important decisions like ability to school board to sell property and things like that. We never talk about that aspect of public.
Well, good point. Thank you, Mike. That's right. We have school board meetings and city council meetings and all that stuff, and hardly anybody goes to those.
Mike's exactly right, and that's a great point. Wisconsin and some of the upper Midwest states, as well as New England, that's where you see most of this very direct democracy of the town meeting kind of system. And I think that's one reason why we hardly ever talk about it, because very few districts use it much anymore. It tends to be in more rural areas. And Mike's right. Often we get very little participation. In New England, I know that they have a very hard time getting people out to vote on things like the town budget. And often it's a protest vote, which means it takes forever to get a town budget passed, and there's constant holdovers about spending. So they can be really problematic. And the other problem is an issue of legitimacy. If so few people participate, is the outcome legitimate? Because have the public really expressed their will through that kind of vote? And so I think that's one reason why you don't see it used as much anymore, because the outcomes just don't really seem to reflect the public will.
Yeah, and there are sometimes big crowds will show up for a public hearing on a legislative bill, for example, if it's a real hot-button controversial issue. But then there's complaints that these hearings are held often during the day when people are working and not everybody can come to Madison to testify before a public hearing.
Exactly. And others will also argue that technology has given us different venues by which we can express ourselves. So you can go on chat rooms, you can post comments on media websites, you can have your own blog. And so it's not necessary for you to go to Madison or even go to your town hall meeting, because there's such an immediacy to the communications process today that we don't really need to have these kinds of town meetings. You can express yourself in myriad ways.
There's also movement to vote in a variety of ways, even online voting. Do you see that coming and changing things?
I think that, at least in the near term, there's too much trepidation about the problem of fraud. If we're talking about voter IDs, that we are in Indiana and Pennsylvania and South Carolina and Wisconsin and the like, and potential of in-person fraud, I can only imagine the debates we'll have about internet voting and the like, and who's casting the ballot, and is it going to be valid or not. So I think that that's going to be a tricky one to overcome because of those sorts of limitations. It's not as though that we won't be able to solve those problems, but I just don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And again, I think there's been a retreat even from other forms of voting, where you can do it much earlier, and you can do it up to the day of the election, but not at the polling site. A lot of states have pulled back, again, because of issues of potential fraud and whether or not it's having an effect on the outcome of the elections.
Wesley emails from Eau Claire. Voting is the right upon which all other rights are based. If you do not vote, you have no rights, no voice, no say. A quick react to that.
And I think that's the people who are objecting to the voter ID laws around the nation, that's the argument that this is a fundamental right. You'll often hear individuals say that, well, you need an ID to get on an airplane. But as the writer notes, this is something that's truly fundamental to the way in which the system works, and that's why there's so much objection to these kinds of hurdles that are placed in front of people to go and get a ballot and vote.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Charlie Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. By the way, the week of August 6th here on the Ideas Network, we are going to be covering the congressional primaries here on the Joy Cardine Show. We will be inviting the candidates who are running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District and I believe the 6th Congressional District, where there are primaries. and that will be during our 7 o'clock hour the week of August the 6th. In the 3 p.m. hour of Ben Marin's show, At Issue with Ben Marins, he will be inviting all of the candidates running for Senate in the primary. So we hope that you will mark that on your calendar and join us then. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and Naya Mukherjee for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.